It is Saturday, October 1st, 2011. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. In the first half, we'll be talking about geek news of the week, and the second half, we'll invite your calls with questions and comments about technology.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI.
It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. We appreciate his song, and I hope you do as well. If you'd like to make a song for Geek Speak, please feel free to send it to us. It's a Creative Commons endeavor, share and share alike. In the second half of the show, we'll be inviting you to join via phone our conversation about technology. The number is 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. Learn more online at RamirezDDS.com. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the airroom with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy and sometimes Stanford instructor. Good morning, Ben.
Hi.
Mr. Ben Jaffe, I think I'm going to start with you since I don't know what Miles will be talking about yet. Hopefully he does. Let's talk about Amazon first.
I don't know what I'm talking about either. very ad hoc morning. No. So Amazon just came out with a couple new products. One of them being the new line of Kindles. And this is really exciting for me and also really frustrating because I just bought myself a replacement Kindle after my first one broke. And they just announced the new Kindles.
How long ago did you buy it?
Because
I believe Amazon has a 30-day or...
3 or 4 weeks. Probably 31 days, I think.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I think it was 32 days.
No. Ben, you having your Kindle, I've rekindled my interest in Kindles.
It's pretty bad. I as well. I wasn't expecting it. And to be honest, the top of the line one, the Kindle Fire.
Yeah, that's the new one, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't interest me as much as the black and white one.
Yeah, same here.
Oh, it's color?
It's color.
Yes.
So here's the deal. We've got the normal Kindle, which doesn't have a keyboard anymore. The lowest end doesn't have a keyboard anymore. And it just has Wi-Fi. Then we also have the Kindle Touch and the Kindle Touch 3G. So that's kind of like the current Kindles, except it has a touchscreen. So you can actually, it's e-ink. It's like the same technology as before. Looks like paper, but you can touch the screen.
And they don't have backlights, right?
And they don't have backlights. Yeah. No,
that's the thing about the Kindle. Let me just clarify for people that don't know the Kindle and haven't used it. The thing that's very different from a Kindle versus like an iPad is that the Kindle has a type of technology that's called e-ink, and it very much emulates paper. It's only reflective. It doesn't have a backlight. It's either white or black, little tiny dots, and it can produce grayscales to some degree with dithering.
16 color.
Oh, 16 color grayscale.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then so it can provide more than that with dithering.
All right. So you get a really nice paper-like quality to it in the sense that if you shine a bright light on it, you've got the black squares and the almost white area.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely think that's a real benefit. And of course, when you
Readable in full sunlight, and they last a month between charges.
Right. More readable in full sunlight and less readable at night in the pitch dark. You
and
know?
The only time they're using power is when you're actually
turning the page or changing the screen somehow.
Very cool. Okay, so I've been kind of into it. And one of the things that's got me is that you stayed with me last week and your Kindle was out laying somewhere for, you know, all night, and the next day the same photo was on the screen. You've like a hack that allows a picture to be up there.
Yeah, you can jailbreak a Kindle just like you can jailbreak any other device.
So what are the new ones do? And does the Touch have a different battery life then?
I imagine probably to some degree, but probably I from what I can tell to a minimal degree.
What's this hot one that Miles just mentioned? The
brand new. Oh, also I should also say that the contrast of the screen is increased even more, which means the whites are whiter, the blacks are blacker, so it looks even more like paper printed material than it did before, and it was pretty good before. The Kindle Fire is a new Amazon tablet, and it actually has a normal screen and everything like that.
You need a backlit screen.
a normal backlit screen. Imagine basically an iPod, but made, or iPad, but made by Amazon. That's the Kindle Fire. And it's actually, it's very, very, very cheap. It's around $200, whereas iPads are like
$500 or something-ish.
Yeah. So it's a very, very low price point. Obviously
for a pad.
Yeah. For a something pad. Obviously you sacrifice a little bit. You probably doesn't have as fast of a CPU and things like that, but, it's pretty cool. Now, I haven't actually seen one of these, so I'm just assuming it's pretty cool based on what Amazon's
products look like. Does it have a camera and stuff? Is it real comparable?
I'm not really sure about its specs because, like Miles said, I haven't been very interested in it. everyone's like, oh, the Kindle Fire. And I'm like, well, tell me about these new Kindles.
You know, it does have a dual-core CPU.
Yeah.
So it has underpowered that way.
Yeah.
Which isn't too bad.
It's the same dimensions as the other Kindles.
Now, why are you not interested in it, Miles?
Because, one, I already have an iPad,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to be this really weird hybrid point between the standard Kindle and the iPads, mm-hmm. the tablets of the world.
Yeah, iPads have Kindle. You can download the Kindle software, and you can read your Kindle books on your iPad. So where is the Fire fit in?
So I was thinking of the Fire as it has like a 7-hour battery.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, well, why would I want that instead of my iPad?
Right.
Aside from price.
And of course, I mean, so the separation.
Except I already have the iPad. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so for people that aren't in this space, you know, they may have a cell phone, they may have a desktop computer. This space in between of like laptop versus iPad versus Kindle.
That's the thing, though. The Fire.
There's different spaces here.
The Fire and the other Kindles, I believe Amazon is correct in saying they're not trying to push them as direct competitors to the iPad. They're not.
The Fire?
It's really not.
It's a low end tablet.
It's like a Kindle with a better web interface.
Yeah, it's a
Kindle. And a backlit screen. That's why I'm not interested. Is because the reason I have a Kindle has nothing. I mean, it's, you know, the interface is really great and everything. The fact that I can read books and everything, but I can read books on any other device as well.
Right.
Amazon has made it possible. I like it because of the e-ink screen, because I can read it in direct sunlight, and it's the eye strain is different too.
And not just the e-ink screen, there's also an aspect of the Kindle that you're reading a book, you stop, it's just sitting there with that page open, and next time you go there, it's still there.
Yeah.
You're not using it for your 17 different things in your life. So when you pick it up, you're not going to go through your email. You're going to read your book.
Yeah.
So it really is like having a paperback laying around.
Yeah.
And that's the benefit to me is the actual non-diversity of it.
Right.
And as you add the color screen, well, then all of a sudden, well, now I can go watch a YouTube video on it. And
well,
then
they're
it
trying
becomes
to,
this distraction.
Yeah, they're, it's a small little like movie viewer. It's like a replacement for magazines because you can do the full color spreads and stuff like that. So it's a very different space than the iPad, which is what you think of as more of a traditional low-powered computer, similar to what people would use a netbook for.
A viewing device rather than a creating device. That's the thing about that I try to emphasize. On an iPad, you're much more in the reading and experiencing the entertainment side, if you will, of the internet, where in a laptop, you're in the creation side as well. And an iPad, of course, you can write and such, but it really is kind of limited to experiencing rather than creating.
Yeah.
Some small comments.
Unless, of course, I mean, yes, you can't go into full programming. A compiler is not
except
really
for music
there.
Creation, of course. It's a really
But at the same time, you hook up a Bluetooth keyboard to an iPad. It's perfectly
it's
usable
writer.
As a,
yeah.
as like what you would use in
Okay, so let me ask you this, Miles. Would you be into this? Take your iPad, get the back of it flat, and put e-ink on it. And anytime you want, you just turn it over, and you start reading.
Actually, this is an idea behind Notion Ink's Atom tablet, which there are a few out there, but they're just not a big company, so they can't produce as many on a large scale as some of the bigger players. But they have a screen that is transflective. In other words, that you can turn the backlight off, and it is viewable in full sunlight, and then you switch it back again, and it goes back to the other view. And it's not quite a month long for a battery charge, but you start looking at like week long.
Right. But let's say even just your iPhone, right? You carry it everywhere. You spend a bit of money on it. Why not add another $100 to it and have an e-ink screen on the back that you can dump content to whenever you want?
Well, with the iPhone, the reason I don't is for the same reason that even though I used it as a Kindle app and was reading a few things off of it, it's really not a good reading platform.
Yeah.
The screen is just way too small.
Right. Mm-hmm. We should probably go on to the next story, do you think?
Yes, and I'm going to have something related to that, which is having to do with not only did the hardware of Amazon Kindle come out, but also a technology for browsing known as silk. And I'm assuming they meant smooth as silk.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea behind that is very similar to what mobile Opera had done in the past, which was you had servers that were grabbing a page for you as a proxy, rendering it on higher powered computers, and then sending the rendered version to the device so that the device doesn't have to do all that rendering time, doesn't have to parse all of those. If you have like a large image, mm-hmm. it wouldn't send the entire image. It would scale it down so you had the best view for that mobile screen.
Okay.
And therefore have much less bandwidth usage and a much faster experience.
Mostly because the screen's already relatively small compared to what the content is that they can provide.
Right.
All right. What's the difference between like having a website that's that has two different kinds of ways of looking at a mobile view and a non-mobile view? This is even different than that?
It means twice as much development time.
Okay.
Or sometimes more when you're trying to synchronize things up. But the idea behind this is that you don't have to retool it for a mobile site.
Okay.
It's the standard site. It's just, but you have, for example, Amazon's services, EC2, doing all the processing to convert that down so that the devices can be lower powered and have, you know, a slower rendering time in terms of graphics power, but still look like they're running very fast.
But do all the features and niftiness of like CSS3 actually function through this thing? Or has it just become like an image with some link space?
I don't know if it
goes WebKit, right?
Is it WebKit?
It is a WebKit
but
browser.
But is it WebKit on the server side? I mean, if you're transferring HTML and kind of concatenating it and making it simpler on the server side, and then you're sending something that's the silk version of it to the client, what capabilities do you lose?
From what I understood, it was just things like minimizing HTTP requests and concatenating files and compressing things and whatever.
Do you still have
and
the
shrinking
whole,
images down?
And
yeah.
Shrinking,
but do
yeah.
you still have the DOM available? Is JavaScript still functional on the client? Do you know my?
As far as I'm aware,
so. Yeah.
Okay. So what benefit does it do besides making images smaller?
Well, that's the thing though. When you're mobile browsing, speed is a major issue.
Yeah.
When you're going over a 3G network, for example, it's a major issue because for a standard PC, if you're or even a laptop if you're in a wireless network, the latency for I want this item and then getting it back
absolutely.
Is very low. So
it's one of the things you're working on at your work is kind of making that faster.
Well, no, it's not really. It's a side.
But anyway, let's go
it's, on. Yeah. And it's not even ready for
okay, but the bandwidth aspect, I get that completely. But if I take my,
but it's not just a bandwidth thing. It's a latency issue. In other words, a mobile device isn't all about how much you can download in a time. It's how fast can you do that request, do that handshake, the TCP mm-hmm. handshake, and then get those small items.
Okay,
down.
But that's you're talking about through a 3G network. If you use the same device, the Kindle, on the Wi-Fi network at your home, you're not going to see the issues with the 3G network. So what's the issue there?
But there you also had the issue with, for example, very large images. The largest part of a web page, as you know, are the image portions.
You're talking about the portable device having to deal with that large image in
well,
memory.
Not so much that. It's when you're viewing that image and you have a screen that's only, you know, 480 by
it's
300
a waste.
Or something
right.
like that. That image that's scaled there ahead of time is going to be much, much smaller than it would be the 2.5 megabyte file that
right.
then gets just
I don't know. I'm not that excited about it. And one of the reasons is that, to me, it seems like creating a side effect situation where you're modifying the client and information on the server and then sending it over, you all of a sudden have problems with HTTPS. How do you deal with that? You all of a sudden have this web proxy that it can re-encrypt all your, you know, you have a problem there.
Yeah, that was something that was an issue. One, though, is that all communication between Amazon and the Kindle through Silk is encrypted.
Mm-hmm.
But it does raise that question of HTTPS. HTTPS is not just encryption. It also protects against what's called a man-in-the-middle attack.
Right.
Someone can't listen in the middle and get that information.
If I go using Silk, go through Amazon and log into my bank and check my information, the only way that will work using Silk will be if Amazon actually can make the handshake to the bank. And therefore, they could theoretically know what my password is and modify my bank information. And sure, I trust Amazon, but not
yeah,
that much.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily think that Amazon would care about the bank information, but I do think that they would care more about the general traffic that
yeah.
goes on. And HTTPS actually stops a lot of that tracking,
right?
Or can prevent a lot of that. And some of the techniques that are used today, and yet with regard to this, it's kind of like an in to become a new super cookie that cannot be worked around without using a different device.
I got to say, I use my iPhone a lot for web browsing when I want to research something, right? And I'm almost always doing that when I'm at home or at work or at a coffee shop, and I almost always have Wi-Fi. I do not notice a big problem with speed. But maybe if I changed that, I'd feel differently. What I notice is incompatibilities with browser issues, you know, that the website works a specific way and it doesn't work on the mobile client as well, Flash, things of that nature. Well, so if a good site, I don't know, it seems to me like the site should produce the content appropriate for the device that it's getting with better CSS files. And that's, but okay, but anyway. Yeah. Silk
and there's one other item, although.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, to come from the other side, you always use, almost always use your iPhone around Wi-Fi points. I almost never use my Android device around Wi-Fi points. Almost never.
'Cause you're on the bus.
If I have Wi-Fi, I probably have my computer with me and I can probably just log on. And if I'm given the choice between taking a minute and pulling out my computer and using my Android device, I will definitely pull out my computer because of the screen size, just purely because of the screen size.
Sure, I get that.
So and of course, Flash occasionally can be an issue. But,
or other incompatibilities with that.
But it's usually like, okay, well, where's a nearby coffee shop? And I try and find a nearby coffee shop. Right.
Have we talked enough about Amazon?
No, I had one more point, which was Silk, that communication between Kindle and the Amazon servers, also represents a single point of failure.
Yes,
that's true.
In other words, if anything happens to the Amazon infrastructure, then you don't have that access anymore, which someone might say, like, well, Amazon's always up.
Yeah, Amazon would never go down, right?
Except their EC2 did go down.
Yeah. They're always up unless they're down.
Well, that's a good rule. Only one of their nodes, though, not all of them.
It affected a lot of us. I mean,
right, but everyone that was always... But everyone that was in one single node. So who knows? Maybe Amazon will be able to redirect and...
Oh, I would assume if the Silk service wasn't available, it would redirect in a normal way. If it's getting,
yeah, that's my assumption, too.
But it does raise that question of what happens if there's, you know, some major scandal or something disruptive happens and Amazon goes away in 5 years.
Right.
Highly unlikely, but...
I also just
will those devices become useless?
But also that's right. And the other thing, though, that's really crucial is this idea of democratization of the internet, right? You really don't want all your content going through one provider. That's not good. And so I like
to... So say the folks that buy music on iTunes and get podcasts through iTunes.
That's exactly the problem, exactly. Yeah. All right, let's move on. That's the mobile platform, the Amazon thing, blah, 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 blah. Ben, do you have a story about like a client-side stuff?
Yes, I do. Client-side web browsers, right? we can't escape.
Web browsers can't escape web browsers.
I'm sorry, Kindles aren't clients?
Oh,
and they don't have browsers.
That's a good point. Darn it, Miles.
Segway fail.
We need a sound effect for that.
Why don't you just tell your story about Chrome and Firefox?
Okay. So Google Chrome and Mozilla Firefox are some of the most popular browsers out there right now. And my story is just simply that, according to StatCounter, which is a company that tracks browser usage, using all of the analytics tools that it provides and on various websites and whatnot, they have shown, and they have pretty accurate, relatively accurate data of all the companies out there that do this. Google Chrome is only a couple months away of replacing Firefox as the second most popular web browser, and that's really interesting to see for me. I mean, Chrome is really, really new. I mean, it's only been around for what, four years, 5 years, something like that, and that's not a really long time compared to Firefox, compared to IE. Unfortunately, of course, IE still has very high numbers compared to Chrome and Firefox. The numbers right now are 23.6% for Chrome, 26.8% for Firefox, and IE is still at 41.7%. So it's pretty high above the rest. But the thing I find especially interesting about the story is that looking at these statistics, whenever Firefox takes a loss in number of users using their browser, and whenever IE takes a similar loss, Chrome picks those users up. So it's not like people are leaving Firefox and, you know, going to Opera or something like that. Everyone's going to Chrome. So I don't know.
Well,
that's,
you know,
a story. It's interesting.
I guess it's interesting. Chrome is 3 years old, started in 2008, and I'm not surprised that the Firefox users are getting hit more switching over to Chrome, because the people that have Firefox are the people that are okay with installing a new browser on their machine. You know, it didn't come with their machine. IE always comes with Windows machines, of course, and Safari comes with Macs. So that Firefox does well at all means that you've got users that are okay with installing it. And I think those users are also probably installing Chrome additionally and then potentially switching between.
And don't underestimate the possibility that some of that increase with Chrome is Google Chrome Frame, which is a plugin for IE so that you're basically thinking you're using IE, but the page is being rendered by request of the site.
It's extremely
in Chrome.
It's extremely easy to install Chrome, if you will, if you installed it in the wrapper.
And there's been a pretty big uptake on it recently because Google Chrome Frame can now be installed without privileges as user mode, without administrator privileges, as a low integrity process. So you end up with the ability to, one, circumvent IT and install this thing because it doesn't actually have to be installed as an administrator. But you also have the ability for some forward-looking IT groups to be able to say, yes, we have this infrastructure that requires ActiveX controls that are built for IE, that require the IE6 rendering engine. Mm-hmm. But we also recognize that we would like to update our infrastructure so that we're not always accessing the web with IE6.
Right.
So,
Out of curiosity, you guys, what browsers do you use? I use Chrome.
I use Chrome too, but I think it's only because I'm on OS 10.
I use Chrome 14.
Actually, no, funny story. I was teaching a class. And for some reason, Chrome was behaving really strangely. The web inspector only had 2 tabs instead of like the 10 tabs it has. And finally, it crossed my mind I should look at what version number Chrome is, because Chrome auto updates. So why would you ever think about it? Chrome version 2. Was on these machines, and then I updated to Chrome 15 or
14,
like 85, Chrome version 85. I don't know. They're iterating so fast.
Yeah.
So,
so what about you? Miles, use Chrome or?
As a matter of fact, I use just about every browser out there because I do web development. Right, so I have on my box of work like IE6, IE7, IE8.
Okay, what browser do you have right in front of you right now?
Right now, I have Chrome.
Oh, I thought you would have WebKit Nightly.
WebKit Nightly is open right now.
Okay, it is open.
Okay, so which browsers are open right now?
Let me ask you this.
Firefox 7, Chrome 14.
Wait. If you click on an email, a link in your email, what opens?
Click on a link in my email.
What's your default browser?
The default browser.
Chrome.
Yeah.
And I switched recently
with Firefox, though, that has been frustrating is the fact that their version numbers have been bumping up, but add-in or plugin authors have not been keeping pace.
Right. Mm.
And which is really frustrating because now Firefox is on this very short release cycle. So it's not as big a problem as it used to be in the past where a plugin would just stop working because they aren't making those grandiose changes like they used to with one version to another. And so it's like plugin authors, you need to...
Well, what's happening is the plugin authors are actually part of the plugin infrastructure is what versions do you work on, and you actually state that when you create it. So you create your plugin, and then 3 days later, there's 4 new updates to Firefox, and your plugin just says, oh, I don't know if I work on those, so it stops working. Even though really, if they just had a different way of testing whether their plugin would work, it would probably work.
There is a new way of testing, which is something that's in Firefox. It's a user can, one, turn off versioning, and they can also say, hey, this plugin works, which provides feedback to the plugin system author to be able to say, oh, well, one, I'm getting notices that there's this new version out, and two, that people are having success with it.
What's really interesting is that the benefit that Firefox had in the early days of Chrome versus Firefox was there was all these plugins people were reliant upon in Firefox. They couldn't really switch over to Chrome. But as Firefox tried to keep itself up to date like Chrome does with all these fast releases, they didn't make sure the development base was ready for their plugins. And so all of a sudden, plugins stopped working in Firefox, and people had less of a reason to stay.
In fairness, I think that their move to a faster release cycle was a good one.
Well, I think it's essential, but I think that they should have probably brought the developers along with that move. And
for example,
failed on that to some degree.
IE6 is still trying to think of what the amount is, but it's just above 10% of browsers out there.
Worldwide, yeah.
IE7 is another 6%, IE8. So you have these 10-year-old browsers that are still sucking up a fair amount of space. With regard to Chrome, you actually have a very, very small percentage that are on any version older than 10.
Yeah.
Even older than like 11 or 12, actually. Like 90% of users switch over to the new version within 1 or 2 weeks of the new release coming out because of that auto update.
Right.
Which is great news for web developers.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Trox. The geeks today are Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. We've been talking about Amazon's Kindle, new versions, and, of course, the Chrome versus Firefox browser space. Geek bit of the week? I've got one if you don't.
Yes, I do. Okay. Since we were talking about Google, this fits in very well with it. Google has decided they don't want to spend the money on lawnmowers to cut their grass in their fields outside of their Mountain View headquarters. So instead, they're mowing with goats. They contract with a group of herders to bring about 200 goats, and they spend about a week hanging around Google and chewing up the grass and trimming it down the verge. And
very cool.
It's fantastic. They've been doing that for a little while, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it costs them about the same amount as it does to use a lawnmower, to have a powered lawnmower and a person doing that. And it's a lot less of a carbon footprint.
Definitely.
And a lot more free press, too.
Or is it a lot less of a carbon footprint? Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Oh, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to talk about Judy Culkin. I've linked this her stuff from our site. She's an artist, and she has a wonderful cartoon about using Arduino. And I've talked about Arduino before. These are microcontrollers controlled by your USB device. You can finally kind of manage hardware in a really easy way. You can hack hardware with these little $30 devices that are small computers connected to USB. You program it through a really free, cool interface, and then you can make lights blink and motors turn and all those things that you would do with a small system. So let's say you want to make your own espresso machine with temperature sensors and release valves and all that stuff that is involved. An Arduino, you could do that with. You want to make a cat door that only opens for your cat? You could do that with an Arduino. So anyway, this great little comic is available from Judy Culkin, and I've linked that from geekspeak.org. You can call us with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. We'll take any calls you'd like today. If it's a tech support call, great. If it's something else, fine, as long as it has to do with technology. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. Ben Jaffe is with me, as well as Miles Elam. And Miles, while we wait for calls coming in, why don't you go ahead and do your next story, sir?
Certainly. Let's talk a little bit about the solar system, specifically that planet that we don't really think about as much, Mercury.
We don't talk about Mercury much, do we?
Right. We talk about Venus. We talk about, well, Venus is actually hotter than Mercury, if memory serves. But and we talk about Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the rings, and stuff like that. But Mercury is this little rocky, small, hanging out by the sun. And for a long time, astronomers just assumed Mercury, it's got to be a lot like the moon, like Earth's moon.
Mm-hmm.
Pockmarked with impact craters and nothing much to speak of.
It looks like the moon.
Yeah. Turns out...
Smells like the moon.
Turns out there are huge expanses of volcanic plains. It has a magnetic field unlike any other in the solar system. It has...
In what way? What's the magnetic field doing that's different?
I'll leave you... That's going to take a while to get into,
okay.
So I'll just leave it as the article will be up on geekspeak.org later.
Sounds
for
good.
People to learn more about. It does have, and those
about
volcanic planes.
Are Earth's magnetic field?
Well, it's unlike in the way that it looks, not necessarily a strength, but it also has elements on there that in general would vaporize at low temperatures, this being... sulfur and potassium, but they're there in abundance, which means that many of the popular theories that astronomers had or astrophysicists had about the formation of that planet can't be true.
Why?
Well, some of them have to do with a very high temperature event early in its history for that creation. If those high temperatures existed and their models existed for afterwards how it came to be now, you would have too high temperatures for them to be in abundance. They would have vaporized already. You would have had them as elemental and maybe in the atmosphere, or they would have blown off from the sun. Right.
Interesting. So a whole story about how Mercury is a little different than we thought.
Yep, and this all comes from the Messenger spacecraft that was sent out only 6 months ago.
All right.
Oh, I'm sorry, 6 months into its Mercury orbit. It was sent out a while back.
All right, let's, you know, Ben, Charlie called in to say, what about Firefox for mobile? What are you using on your Android device?
I'm going back and forth between the typical, the normal browser that's called Browser.
Mm-hmm. Which is actually Google's.
Yeah, it's part of Google's WebKit little browser.
Yeah.
Not Chrome, though, but it is a small WebKit-based, very simple browser, but it does the job. And then there's also a really, really popular one for mobile devices called Dolphin. And I've been using that quite a lot. I really, really like it. But for some reason, with my particular phone, it won't save the cache to the external solid, the external SD card, right? And that's kind of an issue because the Nexus One, which is the phone I have, only has 128 megs of internal RAM. So I keep running out of memory, and mm-hmm. it keeps not syncing things because of it. So I don't use Dolphin too much, but I really like it. I use the browser.
All right. Let's go ahead and go to Boulder Creek and invite Jerry on to talk about your issues with network, I guess. Jerry, what's up?
Hi, great show. Thank you. I've got a Dish Network receiver, and I'm interested in getting out of Netflix and going to this new Dish Blockbuster streaming dealy. And I know that you either have to have a hard connection to a router to do that, or some type of a wireless connection where you purchase a little USB gizmo and plug it into the receiver. And I'm wondering, rather than spending $25 on one of these little USB things, if there's either something that I already have, or if I can use my MacBook Pro, or
how are you connecting? How are you connecting to the internet right now?
I've got a wireless router, so I've got a network in my home, but it's in a very different location, and I don't want to run a 50-foot cable.
Right. So right now you're using your Dish only for TV, and so you want to start using it for other services. But to do that, you need to connect a computer to it.
Yeah.
Okay. And the Dish network hub thing, I'm not real familiar with these things. They have there's a way to connect these up, and the way they recommend is through USB, or they can do wireless.
Well, no, they have a USB wireless. I guess it's a little wireless transmitter.
Gotcha.
I mean, it looks like a flash drive.
Mm-hmm. That plugs into the Dish network system?
Yeah, that'll plug into my receiver, and that'll then communicate with my router.
Right.
Or you can hardwire it.
And when you hardwire it, there's an Ethernet port for it?
Yeah, there's an Ethernet port. That's
all right,
correct.
So what you're trying to do is basically add your Dish network to your home computer network. And the little USB thing is probably just a little Wi-Fi device that plugs into the back of that.
Yes, it is. That's exactly right.
So really, if you don't have Wi-Fi coverage at that location, your Dish network, having that little USB device isn't going to help you if you don't have good coverage.
I do have Wi-Fi so that it'll communicate with my router and get broadband. That's all I need to do.
The question is whether...
I'm just wondering if there's an alternative to buy the thing from Dish Network. You know, maybe something that I already have, or maybe using my MacBook Pro to plug in and use that as a bridge.
Yes, you could do that.
I don't know if that would be easier, but you could do it.
Yeah, you could do it. But $25 for the USB wireless seems like a good deal to me. I'd probably choose that option. Or actually, I'd probably hardwire it because I happen to have spools of cable. So that's one of the things I do. But
even 100 feet of Cat 5 you can get for just over $10.
Right. It's just the real issue is making it pretty.
Because my wife would kill me.
Right, exactly. So that has to do with drilling through holes in walls and floors and all that stuff. No. And if you don't want to do that, if doesn't make sense in your space, doing it on the cheap, since you've got a MacBook Pro, there is a way to do that. And what you can do is use internet sharing on the MacBook Pro. So what you do is you just a sharing preference plane, one of the choices, internet. You share your Wi-Fi internet from your MacBook Pro to your Ethernet port. And then you plug your thing in. But it's going to be problematic because you don't have a lot of configuration tools built in to allow your packet, the things to be the same network. So it might be that you won't see your Dish network system from your other computers. And you might, and it's one of those things where the sharing thing is really convenient from a MacBook perspective. Sometimes we use it here in the studio. We haven't done it for years when things fail. But it's not something that's really easy to configure, and it's definitely not something that I would use as my, definitely this is how I'm doing it.
Right. I think it's educational from a networking standpoint, and for that reason, I don't want to dissuade you from it. But if you're just thinking about, I don't care how it works, I just want to get it to work, then right. it just becomes a question of how much is your time worth versus that $25 USB dongle.
Right. Yep. Sounds like I'm buying the $25 Giga.
And then you're letting us know how it works.
I will.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Really love the show. Thanks a lot.
Thanks you, Jerry. Thank you, Jerry, for calling. Jerry from Boulder Creek. We also got a call offline from Bob. We'd appreciate comments regarding electromagnetic hypersensitivity and smart meters, Wi-Fi, and wireless. Yeah, we don't cover that kind of topic on the show, mostly because we're not doctors. Also, every time we do talk about it, we seem to get a lot of negative feedback from people.
And Dr. Don covered it quite well. I believe it was 5 weeks ago.
And that is on that's available on the website for Dr. Don. You can go download the podcast from iTunes and still get it.
Yeah, I believe it's in her title. You can look up smart meters.
And she
for
covered
archives.
It really well, so I think we'll let that stand. I recommend Dr. Don's show to anybody that wants to know more about medical information. She's wonderful. All right, so let's go ahead and take... Well, I guess we have time for one more of your stories, Ben. Go ahead.
Sure. So we've covered Spotify a couple times, Spotify being the music service that you pay a subscription fee for, and you can get pretty much unlimited music for all the music they have in their library, which is almost everything, right? Mm-hmm. And we've covered that. We've covered this before. It's recently come to the U.S. just a couple weeks ago. Well, now they tried this new thing where when you go to sign up, it says you need a Facebook account to register for Spotify. And that makes me feel a little bit weird. And that's actually made a lot of people feel a little bit a lot weird. And there have been a number of blog articles about it and somewhat of a backlash towards Spotify. And Spotify has recently defended its kind of link up with Facebook, basically saying that, they want to make it easier for people to sign up to get involved with Spotify and everything. But at the same time, from the screenshots I can see, it's more difficult to create an account without Facebook, mm-hmm. you know, by far. It's like, so actually, here's the quote that I really like from this article. Quote, I'd be happier if Spotify didn't deem Facebook a passport, right? So, that's kind of the thought that I want to leave us with is Facebook isn't really a passport, you know, for a number of different reasons, one of them being security, one of them being it's not required by the government and hopefully it never will be, you know.
It sure is getting that way, though, in a lot of sense. This whole idea of logging with your Facebook account, this just makes that one authoritative body, and I just... Mm-hmm.
As opposed to logging with your Google account?
Same thing.
You know? I don't like that either.
Any one service. I like the idea of a unified password and one authentication system, but I'd much rather it be open IDs that I choose.
Well, that's the thing, though, is that Facebook... Well, yeah, if it's open ID and that type of federated login, because both Facebook and Google, among other, and Yahoo support open ID, and you can use their account as an open ID account.
Right.
It's just those sites that are hard-coded to one particular provider. That's what you have.
And it sounds like Spotify's kind of doing that.
Well, think about Delicious, the bookmarking service. For a while, Yahoo had just bought them, and then they made it so you couldn't sign up for a normal Delicious account, and you had to go through a Yahoo account. If you didn't have a Yahoo account, you had to make one.
At least they grandfathered in the old ones, though.
Yes, they did.
I mean, I didn't lose my username.
The weirdest thing about that, though, was that accounts like yours, which had been created before the Yahoo purchase, mm-hmm. Had more features and more abilities than the Yahoo ones.
Yep.
But, you know, no one uses Yahoo anymore. I mean, that's kind of rude to say.
A lot
of people don't use Yahoo.
I use Delicious and I use Flickr, so I use Yahoo. I just don't use
I have
Yahoo.
Two Yahoo email accounts that I use.
Well, I probably have five, but I don't know the passwords to any of them anymore. So
Oh my gosh, you lose a track of your accounts?
I do.
What kind of geek are you?
I know. But, I mean, I've tried to get these accounts back. But, I mean, you know, a 15-year-old brain comes up with bizarre things that you can't reverse engineer later.
I never had a 15-year-old brain thinking about passwords, so that's cool.
Oh, that's good. That's bad. That's good for me, I guess.
Let's go ahead and go.
Yeah, some of us were born before the internet.
Some of us were never 15 years old.
Some of us are still 15 years old. Or
yeah.
Some of you, I should say.
I will always be 15 years old on the show. Young jokes and, you know.
From SoCal, Rich, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. HTTPS, when I browse to a site there and I get this stupid... notice that says some of the items on this site are secure and some are not. Do you want to see this? Do you want to see that? Do you want to see all content? Sometimes I answer one way, sometimes I answer another. Can you tell me what the implications are each way?
Yeah.
means my developer was sloppy.
It's probably nothing to worry about. You okay. Probably just say yes.
Just say yes.
But let's go into a little
bit. Well, it depends on what you're wanting to do with it, because there are reasons why it wouldn't be a good idea. If mm-hmm. your bank site is doing that,
don't do
that's
it.
A problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
If you're buying something, it's not that's a, well, you probably wouldn't want to. It's not as big of a deal. And if it's just some general site out there that happens to be using HTTPS, it's sloppy, but it's not a big deal at all.
So this is what it generally means. A web server can respond with HTTP, which is non-secure, and secure as well. And then the page itself calls for a whole bunch of different images and other things. And every time the page says, hey, put an image here, put a file here, the web client, your browser, is going to go and do that again. And if you mix them up, if you say, load this page through HTTPS, so that page itself is safe. Now load this image file with non-secure, non-HTTPS, then the browser goes, wait a second, this could be potentially dangerous. And Miles will talk about how that could be dangerous in general in a moment. But first, I just want to tell you that that's what's happening, is the browser has to make lots of calls. And because one content is actually secure, it wants to make sure that the entire page is secure, so you're not in a situation where right. it's not secure, even though you're being tricked.
So are there people in secret rooms in the Ukraine trying to figure out how to use this as an exploit?
No, it's not so much that. It's usually more of the person in the coffee shop with you.
Oh.
It's, the issue is more to do with the fact that if you go through an HTTPS connection, other than the IP address on both ends, like the server you're connecting to and your machine, no one else can see anything that's going on. They right. can't tell you. They can't tell what type. They can't tell if you're going to your bank or if you're going to the local restaurant website to see what the menu is.
Except for the NSA, right?
No, actually, no. They can't see it either.
They can't break the encryption?
As far as we know, no.
Okay.
And we're talking about really huge numbers, so unless there's a defect there, and a lot of people would like to know that, but it's...
Yeah.
And it's looked at all the time, and when any kind of defect emerges, there's a lot of talk about it. And then it normally pans out to, oh, well, this exploit would only work if the computer was totally compromised, right. and it doesn't happen anyway.
Now, so if you have that mixed mode, however, where all the text is coming in through HTTPS, a secure connection, but then all the images are coming through an unsecure channel, mm-hmm. it means that someone who is listening on the network, on the local network segment, which could happen like in a coffee mm-hmm. shop or wherever...
knows where you're going.
Could be able to deduce, like, A, where you're going to, B, what types of things you're looking at, and if the website is not made well, it means that some non-secure items that, you know, an image that may be dependent upon the information that you're looking at may be coming in through the clear and leaking some data out.
Yeah, so right. if you're on Facebook, for example, your friend's profile images might be in the clear if this were the... Right. If Facebook was sloppy.
So if it's just images, the only thing that they can deduce is kind of where it's coming from and what you're looking at potentially in the images space, which is potentially
And if you're
bad.
Looking at a restaurant website,
who
not
cares,
so bad.
Right? But there's another aspect, that if you included a JavaScript file and that was not through HTTPS... then you have a really serious problem, because the person that's looking at the traffic that's not HTTPS could actually respond with their own content, potentially. It's called a man-in-the-middle attack, faster, and pretend and give a file to your browser that says, hey, all the information that you're currently using, start sending it over here.
Yikes.
And that's not a likely scenario, but it's a possibility. And that's why we say in a banking situation, if that's happening, there's a serious problem. Mostly because... the bank's not going to do this, right? They're
right.
not going to do this because they want to make sure that the users are all really happy with their website, because if they don't do that, it costs more money for them.
Right.
So they're really good about this kind of thing.
Okay.
So I would say it really has to do with whether you think where you are is really important, that kind of thing.
Okay.
All right?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
And I do want to stress to folks that you're not doing anything wrong if you're confused as to what you should be doing or not doing. And this is coming from someone who has done it before. It's sloppiness on the part of the person who's making the website. It has nothing to do with anything you may have anything that you may or may not have done wrong, or choice that you're making.
I recall a real basic one was long ago when I was working for a company. I was a webmaster. We were doing transactions. We did HTTPS, of course, for all of our security stuff. But the system that was doing that bank authentication stuff and taking credit cards also was that kind of front-end page where people would come and visit from AOL. It was a linking thing. And then we would start selling advertising on top of on the banners of this page. But the way that you track advertising in the early days was you make the image appear from your advertiser. So the advertiser had to be HTTPS as well for us not to get these errors. And it became a problem where we had to build a whole system in place to deal with this. And for a short period of time, we were allowing that error to emerge. But of course, it affected our sales, so we changed it. And again, this complexity of when it's safe and when it's not safe, it is not, there isn't a simple answer, actually. And that's why it's so difficult, because Miles and I, with the, 30 years combined experience producing websites, we inherently look at the URL. We are always doing this assessment stuff that just, we don't even do it about thinking. You know, it's kind of like walking for us. Whether it's safe or not has to do with a lot of factors. And of course, we always jump down to the source code and see what's being included in the page and figure out exactly what's happening.
But to give an analogy, just so folks have a better idea of what we're talking about here, imagine you have a car. And
first, we're taking calls with questions and comments. 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. We have a car.
You have a car. You just got this car and you're driving down the road. And the door, if you have it all the way closed, will rattle. But if you have it a little bit ajar where it's not actually open, it still has that latch associated with it. You know what you're talking about. You almost close the door and it doesn't really open, but you can't do anything except, you know, shimmy it to close it or to bump your butt against it. Then it doesn't rattle. But you have a potential safety issue there, right? Because then it's going to, it might fly open in an accident.
Not that much of a safety issue.
Right, but it's only if you got into an accident
that
it might make a difference. It would make a difference with the structural integrity. And then it's a possibility.
Right.
That's the type of thing we're talking about here. And it's something that it shouldn't happen because, you know, Toyota or Ford or GM should have fixed it so there wasn't a rattle in the first place.
But
it's the same type of thing with web development. It's like those web developers shouldn't have made it so you had to make the choice in the first place.
Right.
But since you did, there's no real right answer. It depends upon the scenario and your comfort
level. If you've got the kids in the car, You want to fix the problem.
Right.
Right. If you're going to your bank account, don't do that. Yeah. Oh, that's cool. I like the analogy.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, we have a few more minutes of the show, and since we haven't had another call, which I'm inviting, 1-800-655-5877, I'll go ahead and go to Miles. He's got another story.
Yes. The reference manual on scientific evidence was released on Wednesday.
From whom?
This is from the National Research Council. This is basically a manual for judges, for legal professionals, to have some idea of what is valid science, what is not. And it is not meant to be, not meant to instruct judges on what evidence should be admissible or not. But it is telling them a guideline of this is well-accepted science, this is not, this is, you know, that type of thing. And it's supposed to quote, assist judges with the management of cases involving complex scientific and technical evidence. So
wait, is it a reference to lots of evidence or is it a reference to a way of thinking?
It's a reference to a lot of different types of evidence that will come up in cases so that they'll have a knowledge so that they're not overwhelmed with any scientific gobbledygook, as it may be, that may come forth. They'll have a reference to be able to say, okay, let me make some sense of this. Where does this fit in? This is actually legitimate, or is this someone trying to, you know, blow smoke in my face because I can't tell the difference because I don't have a physics background, you know, that type of thing.
Okay. I guess I want more clarity. Is this a giant, giant volume? It seems like to deal with this.
If you want to pay $80, you can get a paperback version of it. It is over 1,000 pages long.
Okay.
But it's also available for free to download
and
read online.
I want to see this.
It has
free is good.
Yeah, it has this new version has an introduction by U.S. Supreme Court Associate Justice Stephen Breyer. It has chapters on forensic science, mental health, and neuroscience. These are some new chapters. It's not the first version to be released.
Is it going
to
address the errancy in memory?
But it does not have. Yeah, I believe it does actually. But it does not cover anything related to computer science, unfortunately.
Interesting. Well, I mean, and that's a big subject. The errancy in memory thing is one that really concerns me because, of course, right now we take a lot of...
That's actually something that already is covered. From what I know of the law, people I talk with the law, they are aware of the errancy of eyewitness testimony. I mean, there's been more than enough in terms of case law for people to know that people who are eyewitnesses and then the evidence shows that through DNA evidence that the person couldn't possibly have done it. I mean, people know in the legal community that it can be fallible. It's usually done on if it's the best evidence available type of thing.
Right. Which makes sense, of course, because even if you have somebody saying the memory is this, you still have a potential if they're lying. And because of that, whether it's intentional or non-intentional mistruth, it's still from the observable audience, the juror, the judge. It's
more
still
to the point, a traumatic event. We don't keep clear memories of a traumatic event.
Right.
We either block out certain portions. We try to make sense of it by inserting information.
Yeah, which is lucky for our relationship, I got to say.
Not even just traumatic events. Everything. But especially traumatic events.
One more news story, Ben.
Yeah, I got a real quick one, which is Sesame Street. I love Sesame Street.
I do too.
Yeah. And also, as a musician, they have some great music. Really, really good music in Sesame Street. Anyway, they, this season, are going to be talking about science and math and engineering and technology.
Cool.
Which I think is phenomenal. It's fantastic. Because, you know, Sesame Street hasn't really talked especially much about these different topics. And yet the producers are saying, like, hey, we have a serious problem in the U.S. with regard to science, technology, engineering, math, you know, and our literacy rates in those fields compared to other countries, compared to what we can do. And so Sesame Street is trying to apply the Sesame Street effect to that, the Sesame effect, which is actually a well-studied effect where exposure to Sesame Street actually means higher achievement in high school in this particular study with regard to whatever things that they covered. So it's kind of fantastic.
That's very cool. I'm curious. I guess I want to see them. I want to see what they,
me
how
too.
They address it and such.
Yeah, they'll be doing like science experiments and they've got the characters doing these things and everything.
Very cool. Geeks Beyond KOSP is supported by Brinks Awards and Signs, located in Santa Cruz on Benito Avenue near Branson Ford and Water, specializing in engraving, plaques, trophies, signs, memorials, and personalized gifts. Now open on Saturdays online at brinksawards.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we appreciate the Puppet Master for its use. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. And of course, everything we talk about on GeekSpeak, we put up notes on and such on the today's show page at geekspeak.org. Conflict is inevitable. Frustration is not. Struggles with a neighbor, family member, coworker, employee or employer, landlord or tenant can be resolved cheaply and gracefully with the help of the Conflict Resolution Center of Santa Cruz County. You can find out if mediation is right for you or get help working it out on your own at 475-6117. Information is at crcsantacruz.org. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Cruzio Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is at cruzio.com. The geeks today were Miles Elam. Miles Elam is a software engineer and political junkie. Thank you, Miles, for being here.
Software engineer?
Software engineer and political junkie. And a pesterer of Lyle. And we also have Mr. Ben Jaffe. And Ben Jaffe is a freelance media guy and teacher.
Yeah. And also a pesterer of Lyle.
Yes, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Coming up next is Car Talk. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening to Geek Speak on KOSP.